Welcome to the Biblical Literacy Broadcast, where we study the principles of historical, grammatical, and literary interpretation of Scripture. With today's lesson, here's Dr. Andrew Sargent.
What I want you to notice is that every single story in this section has the same story pattern. Every single one of these paragraphs contains a story that creates an impossible situation, not a difficult situation, a situation in which the experts have done everything that they know to do, and they failed. Now, the second thing that happens is, in the midst of this failure, someone approaches Christ. They seek his help. Having sought Jesus' help, Jesus solves the impossible situation. But he doesn't just solve it. He solves these amazingly impossible situations in some amazingly impossible way. Mark puts little triggers in the story to tell you that something out of the ordinary, even for Jesus, is taking place in each one of these. And then the response of the witnesses to the acts of Christ is fear, marvel. They're astounded, they're terrified, they cannot believe what they have just seen. All right, so let's look at what we're dealing with here. Watch for the emergence of terms in each of the stories that deal with belief. So in the first paragraph, Jesus has gotten into a boat and pushed offshore in order to teach the crowd. It says on that day when evening came, he said, let's go to the other side. And leaving the crowd behind, they took him along with them in the boat, just as he was, i.e., he taught them all day while they waited for their healing. But he rose away, and a storm bursts out on the sea. Now, we sit there and say, well, is this an impossible situation? No. Storms frequently pop onto Galilee. These disciples that are with him are professional fishermen. They have probably seen many storms in their lives as fishermen, probably been on these waters since they were little children with their fathers, and they've seen storms. So in this particular fierce gale, these professional fishermen have abandoned hope. They have given up. Now, one of the things you want to recognize in the telling of this story is that the story is written specifically with one eye on the book of Jonah. Jesus is playing the role of Jonah. If I could read this for you in the original language, you'd laugh at how similar its speech is to the Greek version of the story of Jonah. You'd know that the writer is actually quoting the text of Jonah at multiple points, because they want you to understand where Jesus playing the role of Jonah and God is going to deal with this storm. Now, this storm is coming. It's threatening to destroy them all. They're going down. These professional fishermen have abandoned any hope of surviving this particular storm. They come to Jesus and they say, don't you care that we're perishing? Which are very similar to the words that the sailor said to Jonah when he was sleeping. Why are you sleeping? Get up and call upon your God. Perhaps he will care that we are perishing. And so here they've said to him, do you not care that we are perishing? In each of these stories, you'll find elements in which Jesus is being put in the position of God. He's being called upon to do the work of God, not just the work of a prophet, but he is being called upon to do the work of God. He's going to present himself as God in human form in these stories. So he stands up and he speaks to the wind and to the sea. Now in Psalm 107, it is Yahweh, it is the God of all things that speaks to the wind and the sea, who says, hush and be still. And Jesus, drawing upon the work of God in Psalm 107, speaks to the wind and to the sea. Now his disciples have seen a lot from Jesus, but when they see Jesus stand up in this boat and speak to the wind and the sea and to say, hush, be still, and they are terrified. They were afraid of the storm. They are very, very afraid of Jesus when they realize the power that is actually indwelling their master. And the wind dies down and it becomes perfectly calm, and he says to them, why are you afraid? Do you have no faith? They became very much afraid, an exact quote from the book of Jonah, and said to one another, who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him? The calming of the sea is the most powerful emblem in the Old Testament of the divinity of Yahweh. It is the continual proof that God is the only true God, because he can calm the sea. Now in the second paragraph, we have Jesus coming into the country of the Gerasenes. This is Gentile territory. These are not Jews. You should be able to pick this up on the fact that these people are herding pigs, a very un-Jewish thing to do. So they come to the other side. Immediately, a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit meets him. He had his dwelling among the tombs. No one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he'd often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken into pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. Constantly, day and night, he's screaming among the tombs and in the mountains and gashing himself with stones. impossible situation. People have done everything in their power to constrain this man, and they have failed. Nobody's strong enough. No chains were strong enough to stop this man. Night and day, he's just out there. Now, pay attention. These people tolerate this man. They let him live among them, in spite of the fact that he is this terror, this terrible thing that cannot be constrained. Seeing Jesus from afar, he runs up and he bows down before him. Some will talk about a potential inner struggle within the man, being tormented by the demonic spirits, and yet in himself knowing that he needs help, comes, sees Jesus from afar, and rushes to Christ and falls down before him. And shouting with a loud voice, the spirits begin to cry out, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God, don't torment me." For Jesus had been saying, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And he asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he began to implore him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Notice the constant fluctuation between the one and the many that's happening here. We, he. So Jesus gave him the permission, and all the spirits, the whole legion, which is thousands, okay? And they come out of him in a moment, and they go into the herds of pigs, and the pigs rush down. Now the people hear this, and they all come out, and they find this man who they've allowed to live in their midst. They find him in his right mind, perfectly sane. And they say, "Oh, wow, Jesus, thank you so much. You know, he really made our life annoying. Come to my house for tea." No, seeing it, they become very afraid, and they beg Jesus to leave. They're willing to live with a demoniac. They're willing to live with a crazy man who screams night and day, wanders in the tombs, a man of violence. But they will not tolerate the man who has the power to subdue him. And they beg Jesus to leave, and so Jesus gets in the boat and they're going, and the man who had the legion cast out of him is going to come to Jesus and say, "Please, please, please, let me come with you." And for the first time in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is going to tell somebody, "Go and tell everybody what God has done for you." Because up to this point, every time Jesus does a miracle, he says to the person, "Shh, don't tell anybody what I've done. Keep this to yourself." Because the crowds were getting out of control. But this man, having been driven out of the territory, Jesus sends this man back to tell everybody. Now catch the language here. And he says, "Go and tell everyone what the Lord has done for you, how he's had mercy on you." And the man goes into Decapolis and tells everyone what great things Jesus has done for him. The switch in the language. Go tell everyone what God has done for you. And the man goes and tells everyone what Jesus has done for him. I told you that one of the things that these stories are doing is pounding at this idea that Jesus is God, including the language of the demonic spirit that calls him Jesus, Son of the Most High God. And so when Jesus returns to this territory later, he's going to find a very different reception. That the testimony of this man, having gone throughout the Decapolis, is going to open up the doors of ministry for Jesus when he returns here later. This is the first apostle. You want to say, who are the first apostles? And we always go, Peter, John, Andrew. No, the first apostle is the demoniac. Now, we go into the next story. Jesus comes home, and he's crossed over again at some other time. A large crowd gathers. These stories are not necessarily like sink, 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 sink. Now, the first one and the second one seem to be related by time, but the third one is just he goes back home. And at some particular point when he's talking with a crowd, this man comes up to him, and as he's teaching by the seashore, and it's a synagogue official by the name of Jairus, and he comes up and sees him. He falls at Jesus' feet, and he's imploring him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live." And he went off with him. Now, is this an impossible situation? A sick girl. Well, it might be for us. You know, we might say, well, give her some aspirin, give her some this. But we wouldn't even really think of a sick girl, even a very sick girl, as necessarily impossible yet. But this story's not done yet. It's not done yet on purpose. Now, does anyone remember another story that kind of sounds like this? When Jesus is going and he has a centurion come up to him. And the centurion says, "My servant is sick. He's at the point of death." And Jesus says, "Oh, I'll go to your house." And he says, "No, no, Lord. No. I'm not worthy to even have you enter into my house. I know. I am a man of authority, under authority. I say, go here, and it goes there. You are a man of authority. If you simply speak the word, I know I'll be well." And Jesus is going to, he marvels at this centurion's faith. He marvels at him. And he says, "I have not found such faith even among the Jews, but among the people of God. But this isn't what Jairus says. Jairus feels a need to get Jesus back to his house. Jairus has not had his faith risen to the point of the centurion by which he says, Jesus, I know that all you have to do is speak the word and my daughter will be well. No, no, no. You have to come to my house. You have to come and lay your hands on her. You have to come and do it this way. You have to come. And Jesus says, okay. So they go on. We're not impossible yet, but we're not done with the story. Now, Jesus is walking along, heading to Jairus' house. He's moving through the streets. There's crowds pushing in on him. The streets are very narrow. The buildings are very tight together. It can be very difficult to move through the streets with crowds. Jesus is pushing through the streets, and this crowd of people are following him. And suddenly, a woman who's had it really bad, right? An impossible situation. A woman who had had a hemorrhage of blood for 12 years, had endured much at the hands of many physicians, had spent all that she had and was not helped but had grown worse. All that the medical establishment could offer her was failure and take all her money. She spent all of her money. She's not gotten help. She's only gotten worse. So she hears about Jesus and she comes up the crowd and she touches his cloak, for she thought, if I just touch his garments, I will get well. She apparently has more faith than Jairus does at this particular point. And so she touches him and she's healed. She comes to Christ. Her impossible situations where the experts have done everything and have failed, and she seeks out Jesus and she touches him. This is not a blind faith. Her touching of the garments is not aimless. Like we always think, oh, if I can just get my hands on anything. She didn't want to touch his hair. She didn't want to touch his feet. She didn't want to touch his hands. She wanted to touch his garments for a very specific reason. In the book of Malachi, it says that the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in his wings. That word for wings is the word for the garment hem. The Jews read this passage, and although the passage is specifically using the image of the sun and the wisps of the sun, the rays of healing that come, the Messiah as an image of the sun, the Jewish people also looked at this text and said that when Messiah comes, he will have healing in the hem of his garments and in his tassels. When this woman says, if I can only get my hands on his garments, I know I'll be well. It is a statement of faith in who he is, because the Jews believed that the hem of the garment was the mystical, symbolic extension of the individual, and everything that the individual was embodied in both symbol and in some mystical way in the hem of the garment. She knew what she was doing. She was going for the instrument of power. If you read on the Gospel of Mark, you will find that an entire crowd of people will gather before Jesus and ask permission to touch the fringe of his garment, and that everyone who touches the fringe of his garment will be made well. And it all plays into this theme of the fringe of the garment as an instrument of the mystical extension of the individual, who being a prophet of God, who being a man of healing, has healing residing in his hem, as being Messiah, has healing residing in his hem. Her faith and her belief is rewarded because it is founded in reality, because he actually is who she thinks he is. And because he is who she thinks he is, her act of faith brings healing. So she touches it, she gets well, and Jesus suddenly stops and goes, wait a minute, somebody touched me. Now remember, you're moving through tiny little streets and everybody's going this, and the disciples are rather exasperated and they say, Jesus, what are you talking about? Everybody's touching you. And he says, I'm not going anywhere until I find out who touched me. Now what do you suppose Jairus is doing at about this moment in time? Jairus has come to him in a panic. He's fallen down before him. He says, she's at the point of death. You must come now or she's going to die. And here's Jesus going with him, who suddenly stops in the middle of the street and goes, no, wait a minute. Somebody touched me and I'm not going anywhere. Jairus is sitting there going, you've got to be kidding me. If I don't get you to my house now, my daughter's finished. And you're sitting here worried about the fact that somebody touched you in the street? I guarantee you, he is flipping out. Culturally, he's probably going, yes, master. Yes, Lord. But inside, he's going, are you out of your mind? Did you not understand how serious this situation is? Do you remember when Lazarus was sick and they came and they sent a message, told him to come? And Jesus hangs around for 4 more days. And then Lazarus dies. And when he shows up and they said, my Lord, if only you had been here, Lazarus would not have died. And if only Jesus had been there, then one of the greatest miracles in the whole history of Christ's life would not have taken place. And so Jesus stops and he refuses to go one step further till he find out who touched him. But now I want you to read the way this is described. It does not read well in the NIV, which we've just read. The NIV has actually translated this very poorly. I will read it to you from the New American Standard Bible, which has translated this very exactly. Immediately, Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth. Not that power had proceeded from him. No, that the proceeding from him power had gone forth. That is exactly the way the Greek is wording it. The proceeding from him is the adjectival modification of the power that Jesus has. It is a description of Jesus as if he is a walking power pack. He is like a walking supercharged battery, kind of like the outlets. There is power flowing through that outlet. A tremendous amount of power. Take a key and stick it in. No, don't. Little children, we have children. No, never, 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 never stick a key in an outlet. But if you were, you would find out how much power is flowing through there. It looks perfectly normal. It looks perfectly safe. Plug a lamp into it and you'll make use of that power. Stick something that's not supposed to be stuck into it and that power will kill you. But that power is there. And so the statement is literally the power that is proceeding from Jesus suddenly makes contact and goes forth. Whack! And she is healed. And Jesus is aware of this. This is not normal healing. Jesus has healed people before. He's laid his hands upon them. He's spoken healing to them. He's taken them by the hand and lifted them up in healing. But this is a healing that takes place accidentally by the sheer greatness of the power that is flowing through him, making contact with someone who had enough faith in who he was to reach out for that power. Without a single word from the mouth of Jesus, that power goes forth and heals her when everything that society could do for this woman had failed her. And he heals her. And he wants to find out. She comes before him. She explains the situation. The woman comes trembling. Why is she so afraid? She comes trembling before him when she realizes what's happened to her. She wanted healing. She went for it. But when she got a whole lot more than she bargained for. She got a whole lot more than I think she ever could have even anticipated. And she comes before him trembling in fear, aware of what had happened to her. She falls down before him and tells him the whole story. And he says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace, be healed of your affliction." Her faith did not heal her in exactly that sense. The power proceeding from Christ healed her. Faith is not a power. Faith is not an energy. Faith is not an instrument. Faith is a path. Faith is the thing that allows us to step out. It's the thing that allows us to risk. It's the thing that causes us to throw our whole selves onto God and is in and of itself only validated in the worthiness of the thing in which you have faith. We must never get that confused. So we move on from here. While he's still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official, who is saying, "Your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore?" Now Jesus is merciful. He knows that Jairus has just reached the limits of what his faith could do for him. And in spite of his inability to reach further to Christ, in spite of his inability to step beyond the now impossible situation, Jesus has mercy and steps in. Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, "Do not be afraid any longer. Just believe." And he left everybody behind. He took only the three disciples and he goes to the man's house, and the people are weeping and loudly and they're wailing. You're going to find that in 10 seconds they're going to be laughing. Not uncommon in a culture who hired professional weepers and wailers at funerals. It was an act that you put on. It's not that you didn't feel bad, but you played out a scenario. You played out a ritual. When I was in Israel, we went to the Hill of the Crucifixion. And at the Hill of the Crucifixion, they have a big slab of stone there that is supposedly the stone that Jesus' body was laid on. Around this stone was about 15 women from various places. And these women were wailing. They were on their knees and and they're wiping their tears on the stone, wailing for the crucified Lord. And then all of a sudden, a guy walks up to the group, and one of the women who's wailing, she looks up, she sees her husband, and she goes, "Oh, is it time for lunch?" This is kind of a situation similar to what you're looking at, the wailing. It's not that they're not sad, but their sadness is going to turn around very quickly when Jesus comes in and says, "What are you guys making such a fuss for? She's not dead, she's asleep." And they start laughing at him. And he puts them all out of the house. And he took the child's father and their mother and his companions. He enters the room where the child is, and he takes the child by the hand, and he says, "Talitha kum." And now Mark translates this in Greek. He goes, "Which translated?" Talitha kum is Aramaic, straight out Aramaic. But he wants you to hear what Jesus said. He wants you to hear the words that Jesus used, because he used two words, Talitha kum. And then he translates it, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Well, that's a very loose translation. What Jesus actually said when he took the girl's hands was, "Girl, up." And immediately, the girl gets up and she begins to walk around, for she's 12. The people are completely astounded. And he gave strict orders that no one should be told about this and that some should be given her to eat. So now we've seen a series of situations in which, and impossible situations in which the experts have done everything that there is to do and have failed, who come to Christ in some last-ditch effort of anything. And Jesus, who rises up and meets the situation in a bigger-than-life way, and where all the witnesses are left in terror, marveling at what Jesus has done. That every one of these incidences follows this pattern. The expert sailors who have given up any hope of surviving this storm fall before Christ, and Christ, in an unparalleled replication of the voice of God from the Old Testament speaks to the wind and to the sea itself, demonstrating that He is God in human form. That He, like Yahweh of old, is able to control and to calm the sea, that most ancient force of chaos, that most ancient emblem of death itself. And He has power over it with nothing but a word, so that His disciples that have seen Him do many miracles are shaken to the core and trembling in fear before Him. Who is this that we have been hanging around with? So much so that a man filled with not one demon. Jesus has cast out demons in the book before, but this is a legion of demons. Thousands of demons have infested this man, so that nobody in the entire region is strong enough to contain him. No chains can bind him. That man himself comes and falls before Christ, and the spirits within him, recognizing deity in flesh, say, "What are you here to do to us, Son of the Most High God?" And Jesus, with a word, cast out a legion of demons. And the witnesses to this, the people that have heard testimony of this, who were not too afraid to live among a demoniac that can rip chains and attack people, are too afraid to dwell in the presence of a man of such power. And they beg him to leave. And that man goes forth and preaches what God, the Lord, has done for him through the person of Jesus Christ. When he comes back and we have a sick girl, it's not bad enough yet. Now, in any other instance, the healing of a sick girl would have shown up somewhere else in the gospel. But in this sermon, the healing of a sick person has no place. We have to push the event to impossibility. And so Jesus allows himself to be distracted, allows time for the situation with the girl to cultivate itself into the true impossibility that it needs to be for him to demonstrate his lordship. And he waits, and he heals accidentally through the sheer greatness of the power that's flowing through him. He heals a woman for whom the entire medical establishment has given up hope, bled her dry in her body and her money. And then when the girl has died, Jesus, demonstrating the power of God from the Old Testament, the only one in the Old Testament ever accredited with power over death, is God himself. And Jesus, with two words, "Girl, up," pulls her back from death. And then we come to the last story. And Jesus went out from there, and he came to his hometown. And his disciples followed him. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many listeners were astonished at his saying. But this is not the same kind of astonishment of the trembling fear of the woman from the hemorrhage of blood, nor the astoundedness of the parents who have just witnessed Jesus demonstrate the power of God himself in raising their daughter from the dead. It is not the absolute shaking terror of the disciples who have witnessed one who can calm a storm, who can command the wind and the sea. This is not the fear of those who have witnessed the healing of a legion of demons. This is the offensive astonishment of people who don't believe in Jesus. Where did this man get these things? And what is this wisdom given to him? And such miracles as these performed by his hands? Is this not the carpenter's son, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Jose and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his own relatives and in his own household." And he could do no miracles there, except he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. I personally would have been content with that. But those kinds of miracles have no place in this sermon, because the capacity of what Jesus can give to those who will believe, to those who will cast themselves upon him, there is no limit to the power of what he can do. And these people get nothing. And he wonders at their unbelief. Now, who's doing the astonishment? Who's wondering? Who's amazed? Who's marveling? Jesus has only ever marveled twice in the Gospels. He marvels at the incredible faith of the centurion who says, "Don't come under the roof of my house, simply speak a word now and my servant will be well." And he marvels at his great faith. And he marvels here at the utter lack of faith of those who know him personally, who have, through the closeness of that relationship, not seen that he is God in the flesh and that there is no limit to the power that flows through him. There is nothing that limits Christ in your life. Nothing. Except your inability to trust him, your inability to hear him, your inability to even encompass the idea in your mind that you have the power of all creation in the God that you worship, if you will only give yourselves to him. Believe in what he can do. We have a trend in our society. As we become more technological, as our politics in general move more towards socialistic patterns, where we have a spirit in our society where we feel the need to solve every situation. Somebody has to be to blame for everything that goes wrong. A hurricane hits Louisiana and somebody has to be to blame. We cannot get it in our hearts and in our minds that there are certain things in life that are beyond the aid of human capacity. And so what happens is people begin to become control freaks, to begin to be overwhelmed with the need to control everything in their life. We want absolute solutions so that I will never get sick and die. We need a solution for every sickness. We need a solution for every natural disaster. We need a solution for everything that ever goes wrong, and we have to find someone to blame, somebody to punish, because we can't live with a life that's not in our control. It is the roots of ancient paganism that sought in their worship system a means for human beings to gain control over natural forces, over sickness, and over death itself. Only now we are looking to money and technology and to the government to solve all our problems for us. And what we have is an epidemic of anxiety disorders. An epidemic of people who are so overcome with the panic of their inability to control their lives, with their inability to maintain safety and security from all the dangers that are out there, that they begin to crack up. And one of the biggest symptoms of people that are suffering with these anxiety orders is that they tend to fixate. When they find themselves incapable of handling the entire world that's around them, they begin to shut themselves off from everything that's around them, and they fixate on something small that they believe that they can get control of. And they pour all their crazy energy onto controlling that little thing while the rest of their life falls into ashes around them. But they soothe that sense of not having control by fixating on that little thing. It might be a child, a mother, who completely fails in every aspect of her life, but fixates on controlling that kid. If I can just make that kid perfect, everything will be okay. My grandmother had Alzheimer's, and as she began to feel her whole sense of reality slipping away, she fixated on the kitchen sink. She stood at the kitchen sink 16 hours a day, dabbing at it with a paper towel. There was sugar on the floor, broken eggs on the counter, but she kept that sink perfect. Not a drop of water. She buffed it till it shined like a mirror. And we have a society of this. Watch Dr. Phil. He has shows on this about the entire nation that has lost any hope in God, any sense that your life is not at the whim of storms. Your life is not at the whim of sickness. That your life is not at anybody's whim. But that your life is in the hand of an all-powerful God. And that when situations emerge that you just simply do not know what to do with, situations in which everything that humanity has to offer you is nothing, you have Christ. And it doesn't mean you won't get sick. It doesn't mean you won't die. It doesn't mean that your life will be perfect. It doesn't mean that everything will happen exactly the way you want it to happen. But it does mean that you are not cut loose. That your life is not whimsical. But there is a purpose and there is a plan. And you have a God who has you in the palm of his hand.
We'd like to invite each of you to join us every Monday night from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. for the Biblical Literacy Ministries lecture series at New Hope Christian Church on Route 6 in Swansea, Mass., just around the corner from the Swansea Mall. Our present study is called Meeting the Jesus of Mark, an introduction to the biblical theology of Mark. We hope to see you there.
You've been listening to the Biblical Literacy Broadcast. If you'd like more information about Biblical Literacy Ministries, visit our website, blministries.net. When you visit, download a recent broadcast and learn of upcoming events. If you'd like to support this ministry, click on the support button at our website, blministries.net. Or call 774-265-2453 and join us again next week as we continue our study of biblical interpretation.